Support this podcast via our Patreon and get more writerly goodness. Visit patreon.com/nanocast to join up.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of 24 books, 34 short stories, and countless articles and scripts and essays, and I am your guide on this quest to raise your output to pulp speed levels and to explore the cracks and crevices of business and craft in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 419. This questions episode contains an unusually frank discussion of sexuality, and if your kids are in the car, you may want to skip this one and listen to it later on in private. Today, JR asks, in the age episodes of your deep characterization series, you talk about juvenile sexuality and its development. Given this, how do people's sexual fetishes fit into things? How does a person develop a fetish for things like balloons, furries, BDSM, insert random fetish? I'm genuinely curious. Well, JR, fetishes are a complex thing, and they have to do with sexual imprinting. And they can emerge in a variety of ways. Pain-pleasure fetishes, like sadism, masochism, spanking, role-played torture, that kind of thing, emerge from one of two places. They either emerge from an eroticization of the act of punishment as a child, if you were spanked a lot during the right period of development. You, as a child, probably found the act of being spanked to be strangely arousing, even though it was unpleasant. And the reason is that being spanked increases blood flow to the buttocks and the genitals and the whole pelvic region, and that can create physical arousal even when it doesn't create an emotional or specifically sexual arousal. Then as you develop sexually later on, you begin to associate those feelings with each other and get a real charge out of the act of being spanked or having your nipples tweaked or what have you. The other place that BDSM fetishes can emerge are from power exchange. This is a psychological motivation. It's a form of therapeutic role play, and that can come either out of having grown up in an abusive environment and it tweaking certain things in your personality, or it can emerge as a form of release and escape from real life. For example, people who tend to be very powerful in real life will frequently have really charged experiences in role reversal in sexual role play. So the stereotype is the high-powered CEO who gets off on being tied up and whipped. He doesn't get off on being tied up and whipped because he finds getting tied up and whipped particularly sexual. He finds instead the loss of control and the consequent vulnerability to be highly erotic. Vulnerability is a highly erotic emotion. Always is. Human bonding is predicated upon shared vulnerability, whether that bonding is filial or sexual. And so those kinds of role play can be a way of taking a contained risk that feels too dangerous to take in real life, and that can really enhance the bond in a committed relationship, or it can be a sort of psychic outlet for someone who is carrying around a lot of responsibility and stress otherwise in their lives. Fetishes can also emerge from imprinting during critical periods. I talked a little bit about this with spanking. Being tied up can also do this. Kids will often play, like when I was a kid, it was cowboys and Indians. I don't know what the current thing is, where someone's taken prisoner, kept prisoner, tied up. Someone else has to come rescue them, those kinds of things. During certain periods of development, the sexual impulses can come into play in those kinds of role play. And in boys and girls both, but in boys particularly, arousal that happens during those situations can become a sort of permanent fixture of their erotic life. For boys, that critical period is between the ages of about, for most boys, between the ages of about 9 and 13. For girls, it's a little more disparate and varies a lot more by individual. And this is how foot fetishes develop and panty-sniffing fetishes develop and other object-fixated paraphilias. They develop because of intense emotion and arousal in a critical period, which is associated either literally or symbolically with the thing that later becomes a fetish. Sexual abuse can do this for rape fantasies, but rape fantasies can also be simply a way of expressing and indulging in risky vulnerability in a safe context. Role play fetishes, whether it's baby play or furries or cosplay that's tied to kink or anything like that, those are forms of identity play, and they're the kinds of things we all engage in as kids. You know, we dress up as our parents or as people we admire or people we're interested in. We sort of take on the role and explore what it's like to be part of that identity. Some people don't do that a lot as kids and wind up doing it more as adults. Other people don't have that window of identity exploration close on them neurologically for whatever reason. People who are high in trait openness in the five-factor personality model. People who are high in openness tend to enjoy identity play throughout their lives. And as their adult sexuality develops, the sexuality becomes part of the overall role play. And if someone involved in sexual role play finds a community that is supportive or meets other emotional needs, they can develop a particular fixation or paraphilia around a certain kind of role play, whether it's animal role play or furries or age play or medical role play or military role play. Anything involving identity exploration or vulnerability or both is a really powerful emotional soup that can generate a really powerful erotic charge. And for some people, a powerful erotic charge is the most profound feeling they will ever feel. They're just wired up in such a way that they are more highly sexualized, they're more highly open, what have you. They're more highly spiritual. Highly spiritual people tend to get very, very involved with their sexuality. Their sexuality and their spirituality blend a lot for them. People who are so constituted tend to be the sorts of people you will find who have very interesting paraphilias. Paraphilias can be temporary in that they're therapeutic. Someone may be working through a subconscious emotional issue that they either don't feel safe articulating or that they're not even quite aware that they have. And the paraphilia is a sort of symptom of their therapeutic journey in life. Or they can be, let's say, elective. There's something that's simply enjoyed. There's not an internal force driving the person forward. It's just something that they get a charge out of and they enjoy exploring. People of the former sort will be heavily into one kink or another for a period of time and then gradually fall away from it. Or they may go too far. They may go farther than they're comfortable with and it switches off like a light. And then for other people who are not being driven forward by an internal compulsion, and or people who are being driven forward by an internal compulsion, but who never quite finish processing whatever it is they're trying to process, those are the two sorts of people who will be involved in a lifestyle through their entire lives. Culture comes heavily into play, religion comes heavily into play, family of origin comes heavily into play. But basically, the three factors you want to look for when understanding a paraphilia are sexual imprinting, therapeutic need, and trait openness, personality trait openness, according to the five-factor model. Generally speaking, anyone you meet who is particularly into a given fetish, or indeed fetishes in general, will have one or more of those three things going on. And don't discount openness. Openness is the play impulse. You'll find that people who are creative, like all of you, are much more prone to aberrant sexuality than people who are not, because creativity is another expression of the play impulse. And people who are high in openness along one axis tend to be high in openness along others. And not coincidentally, a lot of people who are high in openness also tend to be high in neuroticism, particularly in disgust sensitivity. And if you're high in openness and high in disgust sensitivity, what that means is that you could be the kind of person who will find your particular fetish completely unobjectionable, even natural, and wonder why everybody doesn't share it. But you look over the fetishes of your neighbor and you say, "Ugh! Oh, that's gross! How can you do that?" Because the disgust sensitivity is what protects us from foreign contamination and pollution and disease, and when you're in a world where there's not a lot of that, you tend to project that out onto other social things, especially those associated with your in-group and your out-group. And when you're talking about deviant sexuality, and by deviant I mean not statistically normal, I'm not talking about normative, I'm just talking about statistic bell curve mainline stuff, you also have a significant amount of cross-pollination with what we would now call orientations. Homosexuality, bisexuality, things like that. Those tend to be rooted a lot more deeply biologically, but they aren't always. People who are biologically so composed as to be sort of straight, statistically average heterosexuals, for example, can be functionally bisexual or homosexual because of imprinting or abuse or opportunity. Like people with high sex drives who are very straight, who find themselves in a single-sex environment, will have lots of single-sex encounters or even relationships, but they won't be particularly romantic or even particularly meaningful. boys who are straight but who are sexually abused at the right time by older men can develop a fixation with homosexual behavior, even though their general bonding impulse and romantic impulses tend to run toward the opposite sex. Of course, that doesn't happen with everybody. It depends a lot on other aspects of the personality and the situation when the abuse was committed and all sorts of things like that. Not all homosexuality, in fact, most homosexuality isn't the result of abuse, as far as I have been able to tell from my reading on the subject. But sexuality is one of those things that's, it's both fundamental to human nature and it's epiphenomenological to human nature. So there's both the hardwired aspect and there's the developmentally constructed aspect. And because it operates at every level like that, you can get a lot of really interesting contradictions in the sexuality of any individual, which can be really useful for characterization. And it's also useful stuff to know if you're someone who has a sexuality that you find confusing. It's okay if you find it confusing. Frankly, most people find their sexuality confusing, at least at one point or another, because sexuality is not as simple as it feels like it should be for being something as basic as it is. It is really complex, and it pervades every level of human experience. Thanks very much for the question. I hope that helps, and I'll see you tomorrow. The Everyday Novelist is written and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions. Visit our website at everydaynovelist.com and leave a tip in the tip jar or join the Patreon to support this podcast. The Everyday Novelist is copyright 2017 J. Daniel Sawyer and Artistic Whispers Productions, Inc. and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License.